Welcome to Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy, as well as everyday clinicians, to talk about where the field is headed and how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Womple, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Stephen Holland, PhD. Stephen is a professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University. He has over 300 publications to his name and is the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2020 Distinguished Scientific Award for the Applications of Psychology from the American Psychological Association. He has served as editor of the journal Cognitive Therapy and Research and president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. His research focuses on the treatment and prevention of depression, with a particular emphasis on cognitive therapy in comparison to antidepressant medications. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. As mental health care evolves, CarePaths is leading the way in making measurement-based care easy and cost-effective for therapists. Visit carepaths.com to sign up for a free trial today. And now, without further ado, episode 14 of Making Therapy Better, Treating Depression with Stephen Holland, PhD.
Well, Steve, it's exciting for me to be able to spend an hour talking to you. As we just discussed, we've known each other for a long time. We have some disagreements about how we see the world of psychotherapy. But every time we've sat down and had a discussion, I felt like I've learned something. I've come to understand how you think of things differently. So it's been just a great experience through the years. So I'm really looking forward today. Of course, we're going to talk about treatments for depression because that's your expertise and has been throughout your career. And but clearly, we want to discuss other disorders as well. Mm-hmm. We will get into talking about psychotherapy and psychotropic medications for treatment of various disorders, including depression. So we're not psychiatrists. Our training is not in that area. But clearly, this is an area which you spent much time involved in many clinical trials involving psychotherapy and psychotropic medication. And, you know, reading your work, clearly, you understand both the mechanisms as well as the outcomes of various approaches to mental health. So where I want to start today is an idea you present, particularly in the recent chapter in the Handbook of Psychotherapy and Behavior Change. I think we're on the seventh edition, 50th anniversary. And you make a distinction between disorders that evolved out of a fitness perspective, because the particular characteristics of those disorders provide adaptations for humans, as opposed to disorders which are clearly more physiologically based or neurologically based. So kind of walk us through that. Which disorders are they, and how do you make the distinction about what's evolved and what's not?
Happy to do. And you did a nice job summarizing the distinction. Number one, distinction's not mine. The distinction comes out of evolutionary biology. And maybe 10, 15 years ago, I started having conversations with a fellow evolutionary biologist at McMaster's in Hamilton, Ontario, and Paul Andrews. And what Paul has been saying for a number of years is that depression's depression is not a disorder or a disease, at least not non-psychotic depressions, that they basically it evolved to serve a function in our ancestral past. And we're used to thinking about anxiety that way. We think of anxiety as something that keeps us safe from danger. Pain is something that keeps us from doing additional damage to tissues that are already injured. But we're not used to thinking of depression in that fashion. What an evolutionary biologist like Andrews would point out is that any affect, positive or negative, organizes behavior, and it has an underlying physiological substrate to it. It organizes thinking, at least in higher species that have some kind of cognition, et cetera. And it all is coordinated. It provides a whole body response that coordinates probably the most likely adaptive response to some kind of challenge. If you got threatened by a predator, you want to be able to run fast, hide, freeze, or run fast. If you're getting threatened by a member within your own species, you want to be able to respond to the challenge with that, usually with anger, which again organizes. If you're if you've got tissue injury, you want to not do more damage. So the pain is helpful to keep from telling about that. And the question for an evolutionary biologist then is, why is that about the only negative affect that we don't think of in those terms? Depression, why are we not thinking of the same things? Mm-hmm. So it took a number of years for Andrews to bring me around to the perspective, but he did over time. And in particular, it was an article by Crook and colleagues, biologists, looking at the function of pain in squids. And if it turns out, a very clever experiment, if you take a quartet of squids, sea bass eat squids, squids as best we can tell don't like to be eaten, take a quartet of squids and surgically remove swimmers in two of the four, one under anesthesia, the other not, and the two that you don't then do surgery on, you anesthetize one, you don't anesthetize the other. 6 hours later, you put the four of them in a tank with a hungry sea bass, see which one's most likely to get eaten. Mm-hmm. Well, the ones that weren't maimed are least likely to be eaten. But of the two that are maimed, the one that was maimed under anesthesia is the most likely to get eaten. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the one that was maimed without the anesthesia starts evasive maneuvers sooner. It starts avoiding and escaping. And the moral there is that pain hurts, but it keeps you alive. Yeah. And then Andrews and his psychiatric colleague, Andrew Thompson, Thompson, came up with the notion about 10, 15 years ago that rumination was actually the function that depression evolved to serve. And what they point out is that most episodes of depression remit spontaneously. In our ancestral past, we didn't have antidepressant medications. We didn't have psychotherapists, but most go away anyway. In a reasonable period of time. And then if you follow what goes on with the rumination process, and Paul's got data that speaks to this, the beginning part, when something really bad happens, you spend your time thinking about what's gone wrong. What is it? But then in not too long a period of time, you start coming up with solutions to the problem. So it's a sequential process where the sadness appears to motivate the search for a reason, which then motivates acting on some kind of solution. Now, all that's a prelude to saying that in the chapter we did for the Garfenbergen Handbook, the particular stimulus there was a chapter that Matthew Keller, an evolutionary geneticist, a friend and colleague of Paul's, that they both did postdocs at VCU with geneticist. I'll come back to. They both did postdocs there, but about 4 or 5 years ago, Paul introduced me to Matthew, and I read one of his chapters. And in the chapter, he lays out an interesting distinction about genetic involvement in disorders. Starts with Mendelian disorders, where there's a clear-cut known single gene disorder, and we don't do anything to treat that psychologically. It's medical management. Then you go to the relatively rare but highly heritable disorders. And there we have the schizophrenias, we have the psychotic affective disorders and autism. There, the treatment is primarily pharmacological and psychological interventions might be adjunctive, but that's not where you start. I got nothing in my armamentarium that helps me prevent an episode of mania from roaring down. Then you look at the rest of the disorders, the non-psychotic disorders are all much more prevalent and only modestly heritable. Unipolar, non-psychotic unipolar depression is as a heritability coefficient about 0.3 or 0.4. That's less heritable than political preference, but it's quite prevalent. A lot of folks have that. And then you start looking at that. I start looking at Matt's table, and you've got this almost kind of this ordering. He wouldn't have known the treatment literature, but I know the treatment literature. And in the treatment literature, those things that we start treating pharmacologically, and you know, psychotherapy is no better than adjunctive, then are the highly heritable, low prevalence disorder, 1 to 2% of the population. Those disorders which are widespread in the population, but respond at least as well to psychological interventions as they do to medications and Medicaid with an enduring effect or a broader effect, those will all be the kind of things an evolutionary biologist would call an evolved adaptation. And it just clicked. That's right.
Well, it's exciting because we think about, as psychotherapists, that this is what we do. People are stuck. Some behavior is standing in the way.
Yep.
So rumination, it's interesting to hear you talk about that. I mean, most of us think of this as a pathological state. Yep. And you're really saying, well, that's the evolved emotion and state that allows us to contemplate some kind of challenge in our lives. And gives us the opportunity. We slow down, we participate less in activity, and we have the opportunity. So that distinction between the kind of psychotic, highly heritable disorders and those that have evolved and give a fitness benefit. So I think this is fascinating. So that leads us to the treatment of those disorders that have evolved. And clearly, if you look, as you said, at the outcome literature, psychotherapy is highly effective for those disorders. So, Steve, you know, I was taught and I've read the literature, and the conclusion often made in reviews was, well, for those non-psychotic disorders that we've been talking about, psychotherapy and medications are about equally effective, but somehow the combination was more effective than either. And that was the recommendation. And I have to tell you, frankly, it just, I don't understand why that was. But what do you think of that conclusion now? Because I think it's, I mean,
let me let you finish, but yes.
Well, I want you to finish it for me.
Gotcha. I do an undergraduate class now where the whole thrust of the class is all the things I was wrong about a decade ago. And one of the things I was clearly wrong about, I was my colleagues let me be the first author on a consensus paper back in 2005, where we came to exactly that conclusion. We looked at the literature, and by and large, a variety of different psychological interventions work in the treatment of non-psychotic depression, interpersonal psychotherapy, cognitive therapy, emotion focus, a number of things. Most anything seems to work better than its absence. Medications clearly work in the treatment of depression, but the combination usually works a bit better in terms of acute outcomes. It's not huge. The range runs from about 10% to 25% increments, and usually you only get up in the 25% range when you do a bad job with one of the other two modalities. But by and large, that's what the data showed. And I think that's still true. However, the most recent trial that my longtime colleague, friend Rob DeRubis, and I did over 10 years, three different sites, everybody got medicated, half got cognitive therapy on top of that. Rob and I have produced a series of trials where we keep getting an enduring effect for cognitive therapy. Get somebody on better on medications, get somebody better on cognitive therapy. You can cut risk for relapse in half if you use a cognitive therapy as opposed to the medication, just the straight up comparison. And we did the trial without a cognitive therapy only condition because we just assumed we were going to get it, the effect. And in the trial, we couldn't get a whiff of an effect. We got a huge effect for maintenance medication. If you got better in that trial on medications, better to stay on the medications than to come off in terms of relapse. We actually we treated people not just to remission, but all the way to recovery, and then looked at recurrence. Not a whiff of an effect for cognitive therapy. Two of the three sites were the same as the one we most recently gotten an enduring effect in. Many of the therapists were the same. And if, I mean, for God's sake, if Corey Newman can't get an enduring effect for cognitive therapy combined with medication, then I pay attention to that and start worrying about that. Dave Barlow did a trial published back in 2000. This is in patients with panic disorder. Very similar kind of trial. Cognitive behavior therapy, imipramine, another antidepressant, a control condition, the combination. But he had two combination conditions. One was combination with medications. The other was combination with pill placebo. It turns out that they didn't get a whiff of an enduring effect for CBT when it was combined with active medication. They did for CBT alone, and they did for CBT combined with pill placebo. Now, just studies, but now I'm starting to get a little nervous that if you put the psychological intervention together with medications, you might undermine the enduring effect for the psychotherapy. We're out in Colorado, and we're talking with, I met Matt Keller, and we're talking, Paul Andrews is there, we're talking with Steve Mayer, two great learned helplessness folks. And Mayer said, well, of course. I said, what do you mean, of course? He said, well, you know, what happens in helplessness? We got it wrong, 50 years ago. It's not that you teach organisms to be helpless. That's the natural response of an organism that's got nothing it can do. It lays on the floor of the cage and defecates. What you do is you're teaching those that are exposed to control stress so they can control stress. And the way that then works, there's a descending pathway, at least in rats, from the ventromedial prefrontal cortex down to the raphe nucleus, which is where all the serotonin neurons have their cell bodies. And he said it's a glutamatergic neuron that synapses on a gap in the raphe nucleus. So when the cortex fires, it tells the limbic system, don't worry about this. I got it handled. I can deal with this. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you've got a medicator, you're not going to get that because there's no beginning firing of the raphe nucleus. And what we know from HEB is neurons have to fire together to wire together. You can have the experience, but you won't learn from the experience. So, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. I'm by no means certain that it's true, but I got to be concerned now that what looks like a solid enduring effect for cognitive and behavioral interventions and maybe others as well, you may undermine if you combine with medications. Mm. The thing I'll say in that large trial is we did get a pretty good size advantage for the combined condition, but it was heavily moderated. It was only the patients who were not chronic and more severe that showed us the advantage. If they were chronic, they didn't benefit from adding cognitive therapy to medications. If they were less severe but not chronic, they didn't need it. So again, that's that what I was saying 10, 15 years ago is clearly, it's not right. It's not accurate.
So there's some kind of physiological effect of the medications that interfere with the learning that takes place in psychotherapy.
Yeah, we know there's a physiological effect of the medications. We're not as certain that it interferes with the learning in depression, but there's good reason to think that it might. And we've known for decades that it does in anxiety disorders. Somebody in anxiety disorder minor tranquilizer is just not going to benefit from the exposure therapy to the extent that they will. So it's not like a new idea. It's just a new idea to think about in depression.
Yeah. Well, there's been some older studies as well as some more recent ones that and Jerome Frank was one of the first to examine this, that if we attribute our progress in a treatment to an external source, we're going to have greater relapse. Yep. Makes sense, because if it's the medication that really is we believe is reducing distress, then if we don't have the medication, and we all experience that when we take some kind of medication for any kind of disorder. Oh my God, I gotta have my acid reflux medication or I'm not gonna sleep tonight. But you're saying it's a bit beyond just the expectation. That may play a part in it too.
That's right. It's not to say the expectation isn't important. There's no question that you got that. Frank was a true genius and well ahead of the field, and guided the field. However, in Barlow's study, if it were purely the expectation, we should have gotten in the combination with pill placebo. They didn't.
Yeah.
So, when I talked with a neuroscientist like Steve Mayer, he doesn't even worry about expectations. He's only concerned about the wiring diagrams, and the wiring diagram is clearly there.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, let's come back to this idea about depression being a adaptive, because it kind of vernacularly, it slows us down so that we can spend time thinking about and considering the challenges we're facing. Yeah. And then we can develop some way to change our behavior, change the way we think about this, the way we react to it. So this would indicate that, or indicates too strong. This would suggest that maybe more contemplative therapies might be indicated because they add to this idea of let's kind of examine what's going on with you rather than a more directive treatment like cognitive therapy. Mm-hmm. However, you know, cognitive therapy is the most researched treatment. Mm-hmm. No psychotherapy shown to be better, but mm-hmm. a whole range from cognitive therapy, emotion-focused therapy, Les mm-hmm. Greenberg, focused dynamic therapy, even interpersonal therapy, mm-hmm. Are about equally effective with depression. What's your kind of take on this now?
Great question again. Couple of things. Let me start back for just a moment. And again, I'll refer to some of Paul Andrews' work. Not only does it slow us down, but it activates the frontal cortex. It does, when you get depressed, a couple of things happen. Whenever the raphe nucleus fires, it and I think the term is enervates, means it makes more active the amygdala, which makes you more alert to dangers and the like. It enervates the hippocampus, which brings working memory online. Working memory is energetically expensive. You're going to need a lot of energy to keep hold things in working memory. It enervates the prefrontal cortex, which makes you resistant to distraction. It turns down the nucleus accumbens, which means you're not going to be interested in dating, eating, or sex or other kind of things. That's where the slow down notion comes from. And it turns down growth and reproduction. The stuff you don't need to solve the problem gets turned down. The stuff you do need to focus on the problem to solve it gets turned up. We also know that it shifts the brain out of Kahneman would talk about as type one thinking, the quick, intuitive mm-hmm. heuristic that you need to pull your foot back. You're about to step on a snake in the woods, and it activates type two thinking, slow, careful, ruminative thing. I've spent the last 30 years trying to help patients not ruminate, and if Andrews and Thompson are right, what I'd be better off doing is helping people structure the rumination. Mm-hmm. So that I think you're right. I think contemplation is a very, if Andrews and Thompson are right, contemplation is a very important first step, and it's going to happen naturally. The necessary second step is to act on the rumen, is on the contemplation. So once you think you got something figured out, then you got to be able to act. And that's where I think that, look at something like behavioral activation, where they paid no attention whatsoever to the rumination, but they get pretty good results. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is getting people moving back in the world in a way that is ignoring the problem to go after the solution. So there may be different ways of carving this up, but I think what it means for me is that there may be a lot of different ways to carve this, slice this up, as long as you can come up with a reasonable notion as to what's going wrong and what you can do about it, and then you start doing it, then I think it's going to get you there. Mm-hmm. Maybe a lot of routes to get that. Mm-hmm. Did I get close to what you're asking?
No, that's interesting. I mean, that's the way I think of it, Steve. There's a lot of ways to address some problem in life. Our emotions are disordered, our thoughts are disordered, our social relationships are disordered, and treatments focus on different domains, but they're all impediments that, as you say, we need to think about, and then it isn't just the rumination, but after we get this figured out, we have to act.
We have to do something. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
There's an additional kind of wild card that rolls through this. And the wild card, there's a great article by Scott Monroe, a fellow Anderson who I don't know, and then Kate Harkness, published in 2019 in Psych Review. And what they're pointing out is we probably grossly underestimated the incidence of depression, the number of people that are going to have a diagnosable episode of depression at some point in their life. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they say we've done that is we focus so heavily on retrospective epidemiological surveys And people in their 60s don't remember episodes in their 20s. People in their 20s too. That's one of the reasons why every year you'll get a call from journalists saying, is this epidemic among young people in depression? Well, you know, maybe now after the pandemic, but historically that comes out of the things like the National Comorbidity Study. If you look at the birth cohort studies, like the Dunedin sample that Tammy Moffat and Avshalom Kaspi have followed from birth on, these folks are only in their 40s. Now they're getting rates of diagnosable depression, which are 3 to 5 times higher than what we get from the epidemiological surveys. And what similarly, the studies that pick up people going into adolescence and follow them, because adolescence is usually the time when depressions first emerge, get the same kind of thing. 30 years ago, when Peter Lewinson and Ian Gottlieb and others published the Great Adolescent Trial, we thought these folks are just, they're not psychopathologists. They're, you know, psychology department psychologists. They've never been around true psychopathology. It turns out they were right. They got a lot more, if you follow these people perspective, you get a lot more incidences. But the curious thing, the other thing we have believed for the last 30 years, there's a great observation Bob Post made, is that it's easier to see, identify precipitate for first episode than for subsequent episodes. And what we concluded was that it must be that getting depressed increases your risk for getting depressed in the future. If you look at the birth cohort studies, that doesn't seem to be the case. Most folks who get to have a diagnosable episode of depression never go on to have another. They're the ones that have clear-cut precipitants. Somebody died, they lost a job, they got thrown out of law school, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if they have another, maybe it's one, but it's a really very sharp slope down to the right. But there's a subset of folks, about 15% of the population, that come into adolescence with what it looks like a predisposition to get depressed, and it doesn't take that much to get them depressed. And it's not that the depression possible, their risk does increase over time when they have that one or two episodes of depression, stays the same. They're never going to be that great a risk for depression. But the recurrence prone start at high risk for depression and stay at high risk for depression. And what we've been doing is misinterpreting a mixture of essentially two kinds of isotopes. And it's just a major article. It was on a paper that Hans Ormel, the good European epidemiologist, put together. And I was on it. We brought Ron Kessler into it, and Scott Monroe. And Ron and Scott were finishing each other's sentences. Ron, of course, oversaw the National Comorbidity Study, said, well, of course, you look at the methodologies, of course, you're going to get more, you're going to find more of a prospective study than you will. He had no problem at all with the findings. And it's almost as if most of us could be anxious if somebody pointed a gun at us. Most of us get depressed if something really awful happens, but most of us aren't going to have a history of recurrent depression. And I don't know about you, I've almost never gotten a first episode patient in a treatment trial unless they were chronic. Usually it takes people a couple of episodes before they get into a trial. And I think what we've done is, or at least what Scott and Kate say, we really oversampled those folks who have a lot of clinical need that show up in our clinics. And we think that's what depression is. And it's just a subset of the human capacity to get depressed.
So let's see if I have this right, because it's really interesting, that there is a sizable proportion of the population that has some kind of challenging event and has what might be diagnosed as a major depressive disorder, but it's an adaptive response to that particular stressor or challenge. Yep. And they handle it in an adaptive way, learn something from it,
yep,
and do not suffer an additional episode or very few episodes.
Yep, exactly that. There are no greater risk of getting depression in the future than anybody else, or they were before. And it's what happens is some kind of really challenging event, loss of a parent, the kind of things happens. They feel very sad about it. They go through whatever process is going on. They sort it out and they go on about their lives. And it takes something big like that to trigger that kind of grief response response in them. But for other folks, they get into adolescence with a predisposition, either inherited or acquired, to be at much greater risk. And it doesn't take much to trigger an episode in them.
Mm-hmm. So come back to the heritability idea. So some of that, the disposition to multiple episodes might be heritable, and it might, and I think the Dunedin study shows us as well, some childhood traumatic event, either abuse, neglect, or even the death of a parent, these kinds of things also lead to that predisposition,
either inherited or acquired. And folks who have their first episode in adolescence, which is the at least half the folks have the first episode there, tend to be a bit more severe, to be a bit more come from families, a bit more of a genetic loading, et cetera. And it's my hunch is it's the larger number of folks that have episodes later on for the first time that are the depression possible and not this predisposed. And I think the predisposition prior to adolescence can be either things that you learn, bad experiences, abuse, et cetera, and or possible the genetics. I also think, for example, neuroticism is clearly predisposes you to getting depressed when bad things happen.
But it's interesting that, that you said when we do these clinical trials, the people enrolled are most likely those with this predisposition.
That's my guess. And, you know, if you look at our clinical samples, 75, 80% of them have histories of recurrence. So I think we've really focused on oversampled the 15% of the population that's at elevated risk, what Scott and Kate referred to as people who are recurrence prone. And that's not true for the rest of the population. Now, for an evolutionary biologist, that's eminently sensible because he would expect if something has evolved adaptation, we all got the capacity. It's just not all of us get stuck in the worst of that. And that's also not to say there aren't true diseases. We all have the capacity to feel pain, except for a very small number of individuals who are born without pain receptors, like Elizabeth Salander, Frankenstein-ish half-brother in the Dragon Tattoo. They don't live as long because they do more damage. Something could be an evolved adaptation, but it can go wrong. And if it goes wrong, that's what I think the diseases are. And if I were to hazard a guess, I think something like psychotic depression, psychotic mania is the disease version of what's the evolved adaptation, the capacity to feel sad when you have a loss.
Well, clinically, we know that we see people with multiple episodes and we look at the precipitating factors and they're not major challenges, yet it throws the person off.
Exactly.
I mean, in cognitive therapy, we're looking at, hey, well, you're catastrophizing from this relatively minor event. Steve, the epidemiology would seem to indicate that the prevalence of depression has been increasing and exacerbated by the pandemic. So I think we are seeing an increase, and again across ages, in depression. At the same time, as you well know, we don't have enough mental health professionals, either psychologists, professional counselors, or psychiatrists to treat these people. We have a mental health system in the United States which makes access to mental health professionals extremely difficult to access. We know that most get treated by primary care physicians if they get any care at all. So given what we've talked about, what can we do at a population level to address this issue?
A couple of things, and I'll try to string a couple together. And if I miss any of the points you just raised, let me know. I've been, the last decade or so, I've fallen in with an absolutely marvelous group of folks in global mental health. Vikram Patel at Harvard in particular, his marvelous protege, Daisy Singel at Toronto and others. What these folks are doing is using lay counselors in rural India, who are not professionals, not trained to do that, but they're trained to do some fairly straightforward things, a culturally adaptive version of behavioral activation, and they're getting good results. Now, in rural India, they might have one mental health professional for every 1,000 people. It's even worse than what we have here, but they're getting some reasonable results. And then I stop and take a look at We did a individual patient level meta-analysis about a little over a decade ago. Jay Fournier took the lead, and he identified those pharmacological trials that didn't have a placebo washout. Most medication trials, they spend the, you tell people you're going to randomize them either the medications or pill placebo, but you don't. On the first 10 week to 10 days, they're all on pill placebo. And those that get better for non-specific reasons, you take out of the sample. Then you do your randomized trial and you're going to inflate the apparent effect of the medications. But when you look at the trials that don't do that, if you were to put on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, the pretreatment levels of depression, the y-axis, the amount of change that they get, it's only in the upper third or so of the sample, the more severe sample, that the drugs separate from pill placebo. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other folks are getting better, but they're getting better for same reasons Jerome Frankfurt said, because they think they're on medication, think they're going to get better. In psychotherapy, there's a smaller number of trials to look at, but Ellen Dreesen, Pim Kuyper's very able former student protege, and Pim and I put together a paper where we looked at those trials that gave us a breakdown on severity within, and the same thing happens. We don't get an effect for the psychological interventions, IPT, cognitive therapy, BA, et cetera, relative to non-specific controls, except in the more severely depressed patients. Less severe, not. Now, what that means to me is for somebody who's not severely depressed, doesn't matter what you do, anything works better than nothing, and nothing specific works better than anything else. More severe, then maybe you get into greater specificity across individuals. That is where my guess is where we're going to end up with that. But for the vast majority of folks in the world, my God, let's start with non-professionals. Let's get a cadre of folks out there to do the kind of reasonable things. And then only those folks that need more, you move into the more expensive professional.
Yeah. So a kind of culturally adapted intervention given by paraprofessionals.
Yeah.
Is effective. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to be. Now, you might have to culturally adapt it differently on Long Island than you do in Madison, Wisconsin, but different cultures are going to call for different things. Yeah. Everything that I've seen, and I look at some of Pim Kuyper's stuff or Toshi Furukawa's stuff, everything suggests that virtually anything we've ever tried is better than not doing that. So my sense is virtually anything we're doing is going to be helpful. If I look at PIM stuff, at least maybe two-thirds of the effect is non-specific. I mean, score one for Jerome Franks.
Yeah. But let's not denigrate that two-thirds of the effect. That's a really important effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Why would we not? I mean, do everything we can to do that. And again, my guess is if there is specificity, well, you can make a reasonable account that some of the instances that look like specificity in the literature are just when somebody who's good at one modality does a bad job with the other modality they're comparing it to.
Yeah. Interesting. This, yeah. By the way, Ted Kapchuk had an editorial in the New York Times or Washington Post today about placebos and how we need to understand this effect to improve not just mental health care. He's talking about physical health care.
So a placebo that you're told is an opiate is much more effective than a placebo that you're told is an aspirin.
Yeah. And open-label placebos have an effect. It's fascinating stuff.
All good. Yeah.
So, Steve, what about digital therapeutics? Lots of stuff coming online.
Yeah.
We can help with just about any kind of mental health issue if just buy this app and follow this directions. Gerhard Anderson, CBT interventions, but he also had a student who did a psychodynamic online. So what do you think of digital therapeutics as a way to address?
Yeah, I think it's the Wild West right now, and it's largely unregulated. However, I think there's a real signal there in the noise. I think it's a way that we can go, a way we can create access. And I'm quite comfortable when it's Gerhard Anderson and his students overseeing this stuff. I'm not so sure about some of the entrepreneurs that are out there. So there's some folks generating digital interventions that I'd be just a little nervous about. Some people I wouldn't buy aluminum siding from.
Yeah.
But people that are, if you give me somebody who's good, who builds something that's reasonable, then I think that's going to be very helpful.
Yeah.
And it's going to increase access.
But it's interesting, and Gerhard's done some of these studies, but a number of other people, that the alliance with the digital therapist and the belief in the treatment are strong predictors.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised. Yeah. I want to pretend to be an expert in that area, but I get a sense that guided work is digital works better than unguided. And so we're primates, we're social beings.
Yeah.
And at some point you got to have the person in the equation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about what I'm most interested in. That's the social aspects of healing. And that social part, it not only is therapeutic kind of in itself, the social connection, but it also augments the specific effect because you're more likely to follow the protocol if you trust this therapist.
Yep.
Yeah. So this leads us to therapists, Steve. We know, many of us think we know, that therapist makes a difference in clinical trials as well as in naturalistic studies. Some therapists consistently get better outcomes than others. And I asked you about this, I don't know if you recall.
Back in London.
Yes, that's right.
I've been thinking about it ever since, right.
Yeah. Who are the therapists in your clinical trials? I mean, do you go to, in those days, the Yellow Pages and just pick out a therapist under a psychologist? Or do you really need somebody who is really good at doing cognitive therapy and can relate to and successfully interact with challenging patients? Because we know some of these patients are difficult. They've failed several previous. Yep. So what do you think about therapist effects?
Yeah. Well, I clearly, number one, they're there. You've documented them many times, and I would not argue against the empirical data. Let me talk about the Penn Vandy trial, the study that Rob and I did. Started back in the late 90s, and Rob was the lead author on the primary outcome page in 2005 in what's now JAMA Psychiatry. I think it was still the archives then. We had two sites. We had Penn and we had Vanderbilt. And at Penn, we didn't have to go to the Yellow Pages. We went to the Beck Institute. We got Corey Newman and Fran Schuschman and people. These are people that trained the rest of us in how to do cognitive therapy. At Vanderbilt, we had a little more difficulty because there weren't any many trained cognitive therapists around town. We had me, who might be good at cognitive therapy, but is really terrible with people. And then a couple of other very good therapists in town, but not necessarily good at cognitive therapists. And over the first not quite a year of the 4 or 5 year trial, the Vanderbilt site was running behind the Penn site in terms of the ratings of the quality of cognitive therapy and the outcomes we were getting. And what we did is we sent our cognitive therapists in the Vanderbilt side back to the extramural program at Penn. They got better. They got trained by people like Corey and Fran, and their outcomes got better over time. Now, the people didn't change. Their skill with cognitive therapy changed. No, that's not to say that people's skills don't make a big difference. I think they do. We were picking people who were highly regarded as therapists, not necessarily skilled in cognitive therapy. So I can imagine you've got both aspects are going to be important, although I think both aspects could be most important for the most difficult patients. I would agree with what I think you were saying a minute or two ago. I had one patient on the trial, least responsive patient in the entire trial. We started in treatment that I was one of the therapists in the trial. We started treatment with that. And she walked in the beginning with Beck inventories that were up in the high 40s, low 50s, and Hamilton's up in the high 20s, low 30s. 16 weeks later, and I was seeing her. She talked me into seeing her virtually every day. 16 weeks later, with multiple sessions, she walked out with BDIs in the high 40s, low 50s, and Hamilton's in the now 3 years later, and a lot of stuff, a lot of interpersonal stuff, a lot of pushing beyond the original 1970s cognitive therapy into the 1990s, where Tim Beck fell back on his dynamic training and said, for God's sake, talk about the childhood and talk about the therapeutic relationship and use that as a teaching device, she ended up making great progress, great strides. And I can't think of many people that I've ever worked with that got more out of therapy working with me. But it wouldn't have happened at 16 weeks with a typical therapist.
It's interesting because that idea of time-limited therapy, that you can do this. Well, for many people, you can. I mean, we know this. Many people. And I've looked at the naturalistic data. Most people will get better in 8 or 9 sessions, and they stop therapy. But there are patients, even, not personality disorder, but major depressive disorder, who need more treatment than that.
I think absolutely right. That's why I think a step care approach is just so sensible. I look at what folks are doing, say, with IAPT, I think that's been renamed in England, where you start with something that's relatively straightforward, relatively simple, and not that time intensive. And then for the folks that don't respond to it, then you go to something, you bring in the big ones.
Yeah. And it would be nice if we could identify before they start.
Yeah, wouldn't it though? And I think we've got the tools to do that. The project Vikram and I are doing in India, we're going to be comparing his culturally adapted behavioral activation, what he calls the healthy activities program, versus medications in primary care. But the real reason we're doing that is because we want to get a good baseline assessment of who ought to respond better to which. And we're bringing Ron Kester and Robin Rubis are going to be using machine learning to see if we can identify when somebody first walks in the door, is this somebody to send towards the medication? Is this somebody to send towards the psychological intervention? And we'll see where we go with that. Mm-hmm. I do know in the Penn Vandy trial, the one I was just talking about, when Rob and his students did a slightly earlier version, not quite as sophisticated as machine learning version of that, and everybody in that trial was more severely depressed, the upper half, the folks we expected specificity from, about a third of the patients in the trial, by our indications, could have should have gotten medication treatment, and about a third could have should have gotten cognitive therapy, and the other third, it didn't really matter much what they would have gotten. But of course, because things are randomized, half of the folks who should have got what they should have and half of the folks didn't. And if you were to look at, had we known in advance, if we had known in advance which treatment to give to which patient, we would have improved the outcomes by as much as the medication placebo difference. Mm-hmm. So, without changing the treatment at all, just getting the right treatment provided. So I think that's a possibility.
Yeah. Well, and it's more important than just getting into the right treatment at the beginning, because often we know from clinical practice, if they don't engage in the first treatment, don't benefit. Even if you recommend the second step, they're out of the system.
No question about that. And from my very limited clinical experience, the toughest patients are the most challenging, and they're the ones that keep right on the edge of dropping off and challenging you. And again, that person I was describing earlier, who I spent so much of the time with, I mean, every third session was some kind of blow up. And I've never had a teenage daughter before. This is the closest I've ever come. And
so, Steve, if you're looking for therapists in your trials, what are the characteristics you would look for that you think characterize an effective therapist?
Ideally or in the real world?
Ideally. Well, let's start with ideally.
What's that?
Let's start with ideally.
Oh, good with people and flexible.
Yeah, what do you mean? What do you mean by good? Because this is really terribly important, I think. Because
this just guesses on my part, but I would say if you're the kind of person that can sit outside, walk into new Starbucks, and 10 minutes later you're having conversations with people, you're gonna be a good therapist. And if you're the kind of person that can do that, but doesn't take offense when somebody says something outrageous, et cetera, that's going to be helpful too. So you got to be able to interact. You got to enjoy working with people. Got to be able to interact, and you got to not take stuff personally, because it's going to with the tougher clients. They've got to do something personal.
Well, I would agree on half of that. I think we know a lot of people who are really good Starbucks at a cocktail party. They're charismatic, but it's when the challenge is great, the affect is high, you can tolerate that without avoiding it. So in my supervision and clinical work, it's the therapists who avoid the really strong emotions,
Okay.
Which may be kind of challenging, but it may be withdrawal as well.
Yeah.
Difficult patients often withdraw.
Yeah.
Don't engage. It's therapists who can actually deal with that, with the difficult emotions.
I'll stand corrected. Everything you just said, I would agree with. I didn't come up with it first, but I think you're right on target.
Yeah. Good. Well, Steve, we're running out of time here. We could go on, I know, because we did in London, another 2 hours or so. So,
and my in-laws are going to go to the theme when I do. So, I'll understand.
Yeah. So let's just wrap it up by talking about where do you see kind of the future of psychotherapy, future of mental health services? Are we at the cusp of discovering something that's going to radically change, or is the really to make a dent coming back to this access? What is it we need to do as a mental health system?
As a cognitive therapist, I wouldn't use the term need, but what does it be useful to do? And I think there are a couple of things. I think we have new technologies that are just opening new vistas. And I think the machine learning, if it doesn't end up ruling us, is going to be a useful tool along that line. And the notion of being able to identify when somebody walks in the door, what things might be best for them. And to extend, you could imagine what might be the best matchups with various kinds of therapists or individuals as therapists. I think that's a new capacity we haven't had in the past. I'd say in addition, it's going to make us better at identifying what the underlying mechanisms of change are. Alan Kasten made a brilliant comment in his 2007 annual review paper, where he said, anytime you got moderation, you got differential mediation. So if different people respond to different things or to different therapists, they are following different laws of nature. And that's what the mediational process is. So, but 30 years I've been testing for mediation in an entire sample. What I should have been doing was putting in my treatment by patient characteristic interactions, and then essentially doing subsetting those kind of things. So we'll be trying to do that in the India trial, and I think that's very helpful. My God, when I came into the field, we thought schizophrenia was a single gene disorder. It ain't. We now know that there are multiple genes involved in the schizophrenias. We also know that they overlap considerable extent with the psychotic affective disorders, which we know overlap to considerable extent with the non-psychotic affective disorders, although the non-psychotic affective disorders don't overlap that much with the schizophrenia. It's almost like you got this band going across there. And we also know that even the most highly heritable disorders like schizophrenia or psychotic affective disorders, if you have an identical twin, someone who shares exactly your same genotype, the odds are only 50-50 that you're going to have the disorder if they've expressed it. So, I mean, there's got to be room. There's something we're missing that's going to help us head off the most serious of these disorders. I think in the, 40, 50 years I've been in the field now, I think we're on a cusp because new tools are being developed. The idea's been around for a long time. Now we can pursue those ideas in ways I think are just going to be extremely meaningful. Mm-hmm. I guess. And I think the whole notion of going global is going to be extremely helpful.
Yeah, we can start a whole new discussion here. But the cultural part of this is really intriguing to understand.
Yep.
I'm reading a book about emotions across cultures.
Yeah.
And we all kind of believed Ekman that there was universal. And we're kind of shedding that idea. The underlying idea of emotions and their utility is the same, just like language is universal. But the way, the variations, and I think the more we learn about these other cultures, the more we're actually going to be effective in our own.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. And I know our audience is going to find this really captivating and useful. So my appreciation.
Great, good fun. Thanks a lot. And got a real kick out of this. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.
Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. Their latest release, CarePaths Connect, includes automated measurement-based care and the ability to create a digital front door for your practice, as well as a free mobile app designed to increase patient engagement. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. To find out more about Bruce Wampold and his work as CarePaths Chief Clinical Officer, visit makingtherapybetter.com.